There used to be a charge for bread and butter in a restaurant. If you wanted to have bread and butter, you paid for it. And then at some point it became, you know, just part of the process, right? So it wasn't satisfying anymore. And when you eat a beautiful piece of bread with beautiful butter, it's like it touches us in so many emotional ways. The aromas, the sound, the textures, you know, all these different things that go on with just a piece of bread and butter.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. Despite the fact that he's known as a watch lover among other collectors, and the fact that he's been one of the most famous chefs in the world for the better part of three decades, Chef Thomas Keller isn't out there flaunting his watch collection every day. In fact, I've known that he's a watch collector for probably 8 or 9 years now, but before last week, I don't think I could have named more than one or two of his watches. When I saw that he just dropped a new cookbook, his first in 10 years, I figured it was time we fixed that. So last week, Chef was kind enough to chat with me from his iconic Yountville, California restaurant, The French Laundry, and while we started out talking about why a Rolex is always a good choice in the kitchen, and the pieces that he wears to remember certain milestones from a simple Bowman Mercier to a Vacheron Constantin overseas, our conversation pretty quickly got more philosophical. Chef's new book, The French Laundry Per Se, is full of recipes, but it's also full of Keller's ruminations on what it means to be in a hospitality-focused business. It's about the relationships between luxury and precision, and how the smallest changes can sometimes make the biggest impact. We also get into the relationships he has with his suppliers, and what you're really supporting when you have dinner at restaurants like his. From our hour together, I can tell that Chef Keller is that rare combination of someone deeply committed to generosity and elevating others, while also having a no BS, results-driven approach to what he does. I love those kinds of people. So without further ado, let's do this. This week's episode is presented by Zenith. Stay tuned later in the show to hear my conversation about the brand's latest novelties with CEO Julian Tornare and Product Development and Heritage Director Roman Marietta. You can also visit zenithwatches.com for more. Chef, thank you so much for joining us.
Steve, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me on. It's a great kind of departure from my normal day. So thank you, and I'm able to actually look at some of my watches, which I don't always look at day to day. So it's kind of nice.
I mean, let's just start with watches. I mean, you've been sort of a known watch guy, I would say, in the watch community for years. You know, when yeah. we're talking about, you know, chefs and other sort of like public figures, let's say, mm-hmm. who are into watches, your name seems to come up time and time again. But at the same time, you're not one of those folks who's sort of like overexposed and like pictures of your collection are everywhere. So I kind of want to start at the basics and ask how you got into watches in the first place.
Well, you know, watches have always been part of my life. I mean, you know, I'm of that generation where if you want to know what time it was, you had to look at your wrist. It wasn't like you picked up your iPhone. And so for me, it's always been that form of, I guess, not only practical purpose, knowing what time it is, but also a sense of style, if you will, I don't wear jewelry, so you know it was the watch that was the prominent, you know, piece of jewelry, or you know, that was on my wrist, and I've always enjoyed them immensely, and you know, been collecting them for a long time. I think my first collection started with the Seiko, which was the Museum of Modern Art piece that they had, and Swatch was a big part of my life because they were great in the kitchen. Right, they last a long time. They're very durable, and they were inexpensive. And then I started graduating to, you know, a more refined watches. One of my first watches was a Bowman Mercier FCA, which was a wonderful watch. I bought that on the anniversary of opening, you know, the French Laundry 26 years ago. That was kind of my beginning of watches, of really kind of collecting that. I don't want to say expensive watches, but that range of watches, which are not only stylistic, but also great brands, great designs. And they have not only just a value in the watch itself, but a value to me, because there's always about a moment when I'm celebrating something, whether it's a Christmas, whether it's a birthday, whether it's an anniversary, where, you know, you can have the liberty and feel good about spending some money on something that that continues to remind you of a special moment in your life.
Yeah, that's I think that's really great. The idea that these things, they don't just mark sort of the minutes and hours day to day, but they mark the sort of longer arc of our lives. And, you know, that Baume & Mercier, is that a watch you still wear and sort of, you know, look at and fondly remember the early days of the French Laundry?
Yeah, it is. You know, I mean, I love to wear it. It's a smaller dial than we typically wear today, right? But it's still a wonderful, elegant, simple watch. I like simplicity in my watches. So, you know, this one represented, you know, a style and simplicity that I liked.
And are there other key milestones over the years that for you were like no-brainer moments to mark with a watch, where like the moment you saw it on the horizon, you said like, all right, we got to start finding a watch to kind of mark this occasion?
Yeah, so the 25th anniversary of the French Laundry, for example, Vacheron is one of my favorite brands. And so, you know, they have this wonderful overseas. And the blue in the dial was the same color as the blue that represents the French Laundry. And so I was able to buy one, not just for myself, but one for Laura to mark the 25th anniversary of the French Laundry. So that, you know, those are those watches that mark those anniversaries for us at the French Laundry.
Yeah, Vacheron, I think, is a really interesting brand for things like this, and specifically the overseas, because, you know, you mentioned it with Swatch, but like you're a chef, you're in the kitchen, you're using your hands. Yeah. You need something that, even if it's going to be beautiful, it also has to be durable. And I wonder, over the years, have you found that like certain watches really work in the kitchen and some watches really just don't, no matter how much you might like them?
Yeah, there's two watches that work. I mean, you know, obviously the leather bands. I have a Panerai 1936, right? The replica of the 1936 when they launched this, I think, in 2006. They made 1936 of them. Of course, the leather band doesn't really work well in a kitchen. Anything that's metal, stainless steel, you know, and that's why, you know, Rolex is something that I enjoy wearing a lot. But also there are two which I like. This, the Patek Nautilus with the rubber band, is a great watch for the kitchen, as well as this Daytona from Rolex that has the rubber band, yeah. And they're really, really comfortable in a kitchen, and because of the nature of the material, you know, they obviously are not scratching, they're very easy to clean. So those are two types of watches that with those types of bands that really work out, you know, kind of harkens back to the days of the Swatch and those rubber bands.
Yeah. I mean, you already mentioned simplicity as a thing you enjoy, and we'll talk about that a little more when we talk about your cookbook and your restaurants. But are there other sort of like stylistic or design principles that when you're looking at a watch are the first things you sort of either gravitate towards or that kind of like put you off of a particular watch?
You know, complexity is always something. So I'm fortunate to have two Daytonas, and of course they're more complex than some of the other watches that I have. You know, the Patek Nautilus is a little more complex than the other Patek that I have. So I kind of gravitate to the ones I can look at quickly, understand what time it is, because that's really the most important thing to me is really the time. You know, the most of them come with the dates. That's almost irrelevant to me because every day is almost the same, you know, in terms of where I'm going or where I'm going to be. And there's plenty of ways to understand what the date is. If I just look around the kitchen, you know, there's lots of things with the date on it. But yeah, the simplicity of watch, the easy to read watches, the ones that are durable, the ones that, you know, are easy to clean certainly if I'm in the kitchen. And also, you know, ones that, you know, that really you can dress up or dress down, right? The simplicity of a watch whether it was the Bohm or the Patek or the Vacheron, you know, they're easy with the stainless steel band to really dress up or dress down.
Yeah. The idea of dressing up and dressing down intrigues me, especially in the mm-hmm. context of the French Laundry. Reading through the cookbook, which again we're going to dive deep into, but yeah. you tell the story of when you changed the dress code to allow for jeans, right. and this idea of comfort and the balance between sort of elevated experiences and also comfort and being able to enjoy things. And I wonder how you think about that more broadly, and then how it may or may not maybe connect to your love of watches.
Well, you know, I think there is this, we have to respect that, you know, evolution is part of day-to-day life, and we have to embrace evolution in a way that helps all of us, right? And if we're talking about the restaurant in that sense, we're talking about all of us have a sense of comfort, and more importantly, be able to have fun, right? I don't want to have expectations put on our guests that creates some type of intimidation or some type of effort that they have to make that they don't normally make. Yes, you know, some people love to get dressed up to go to Per Se or the French Laundry, but also some people just want to come casually. And there lies that, you know, either dressing it up or dressing it down, and watches really add to that sense of style, especially for a man. As many men, it's the only piece of jewelry that they have is their watch and maybe their wedding band. But it's about comfort and about having fun. And so that's what we're really stressing the most in our restaurant is the sense of not fine dining as much as fun dining. And that comes with somebody being comfortable. You can't have fun unless you're comfortable.
Yeah, it's a thing we deal with all the time in the watch industry, which is governed largely by, you know, sort of codes of what it means for something to be like quote unquote luxury that are in some mm-hmm. cases hundreds of years old and slow to adapt and all of those things. And I think whether it's watches or whether it's fine dining or whether it's, you know, handmade furniture or mm-hmm. any number of other things have to evolve. Like you said, things have to move. They have to move with us as opposed to against us. And I wonder how you think about that as, you know, the French Laundry now is multiple decades old, and how you think about trying to continue pushing it forward and evolving and growing and having that be a part of fine dining or fun dining, as you just said.
Yeah, it's a generational thing. As you know, and certainly watches are definitely generational timepieces. I mean, you know, the passed on from one generation to the next, they're held with a sense of identity, right? Of a sense of this opportunity to give somebody that's close to you or for them to have your watches or one of your watches after you leave. And that to me, I still have my father's military watch, and that's really one of those watches that I hold extremely dear to me. So, you know, these are heirlooms that that continue to pass on. With fine dining, what we're trying to do is also understand that it's a generational passage. And we all stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. And, you know, there are generations of chefs and restaurateurs that I've always looked to as icons, as role models, even though some of them have long passed. They still left a strong impression on me, and certainly a strong imprint on our profession and the generations that followed them. And so our job, right, our responsibility is to make sure that our shoulders are strong enough for those who are coming after us, for the future generations, to stand on our shoulders and do better than we did. And that's really a wonderful responsibility to have. I'm now looking at three generations beyond me that, you know, are part of our profession now, right? If I was fortunate to be, you know, the first generation of American chefs, right, to own their own restaurant. And that was an extraordinary opportunity. That was an extraordinary realization, right? That you can actually own your own restaurant. I mean, up until then, you know, there wasn't really a culinary culture in America. It had been rekindled in the early 70s. And you look at that and how our country has now become a respected culinary culture, culinary profession, not just with chefs, not just with restaurants, but our wine, our wineries, our wine growing regions, the wines we produce. And then just think about the food that we have today. It's so much better than when I was a young person. And it's all because of chefs. Chefs continue to drive what our consumers eat, what our farmers grow, how we interpret food, the importance of nutrition, the importance of sourcing food, all these things which really drive us and move us forward in that evolutionary process. But to be able to hire, train, and mentor the next generations of young people, not just chefs, because we all know that restaurants are made up of not just chefs, but dining room staff and wineries and wine staff and managers and administrators and gardeners. And I mean, it just goes on and on. And so we have that opportunity to change and to elevate the standards of our profession. And that's our responsibility. And those, our shoulders have to be strong enough to be able to endure that and set the example that is going to continue to evolve to a better place the next generations.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And I love how fundamental that outlook seems to be with everything you do. I mean, even like you just look at the title page of the book, which is called The French Laundry Per Se. It was published by Artisan. It came out in October. We'll link in the show notes so that people can go find it. But you're not the only author. You have co-authors. You have David Breeden, you have Corey Chow, you have Elwin Boyles, mm-hmm. and then Susie Heller and Michael Ruhlman contributed mm-hmm. as well. And mm-hmm. your choice to not have those people have their names on, you know, little individual sections buried in the book, but really to be at the forefront is a deliberate one. And it's frankly, you know, not trying to butter you up here, but like,
no.
It's frankly a decision that many people wouldn't make. I mean, it's a sort of like anti-ego decision. Mm-hmm. And I wonder why you made that choice and sort of how you think mm-hmm. about that fitting into what we just talked mm-hmm. about.
Yeah. Thank you for asking that question. It's an important question. And you know, what we always talk about, you mentioned the word ego, and we have to realize that, you know, as a true team member, you have to leave your ego at the door, right? We come into our restaurants, and regardless of, again, the department that you're working in, it's not about ego. It's about a team effort to give our guests a great experience and ourselves at the same time. You know, we want to be a little selfish in this process, and we want to have a great time too. And so, you know, to be able to establish that kind of environment really dictates to us that ego is not part of what we need to do in our restaurants. But the point of trying to establish this moment in time, right? Because cookbooks are a moment in time. So the French Laundry Cookbook was written in 1996, spring, summer, fall of 1996, and published in 1998. It was a moment in time, those three seasons. When we wrote that book, and those were the dishes, the compositions, the techniques, the skills that we had when we wrote that book, I wanted to make sure that was the easy part, because again, that was a collaborative effort with the different chefs that were in the kitchen with me, whether it was Eric Siebold, Grant Atkins, Mark Hopper, Stephen Durfee. I mean, there was still a lot of people involved in that book, as there are in anybody's book, right? Anybody's cookbook, at least. So it was at the time the only book that I was ever going to write. I had no ambitions to write another book. That was the French Laundry Cookbook. I was able to tell some great stories, the importance of Hollandaise sauce, bringing in our partners or suppliers, as some people would call them, people like, you know, Connie Green, Ingrid Benjes, Keith Martin, you know, extraordinary farmers and fishermen and gardeners and foragers around the country who really make up that supply chain for us, right? Which is such an important part that most people don't realize the hundreds of people that are involved in supplying a restaurant. I mean, it's extraordinary. And so that was the book. I wasn't going to write another one, but it was very successful. And of course, with anything that's successful, your publisher, your editor wants to write another one. And I really resisted for quite some time. And then I woke up one morning and I realized that I may be being a little selfish and maybe irresponsible to the request, right? To the opportunity to write a second cookbook. I had Bouchon Restaurant here in Yountville. Jeffrey Circiello was the chef. He was an extraordinary young chef at the time. And of course he still is, he's a little older today. But I thought, why not let them write a cookbook? Let them write a cookbook based on what we're doing at Bouchon, these classic French techniques and compositions of Bouchon. And so I passed it on to them. Of course, I was, you know, part of that process as well. I was part of that team as well, bringing back Susie as the producer, Michael Ruhlman as the writer, and Deborah Jones as the photographer. And of course, you know, Ann Bramson was still our editor at Artisan. And, you know, when I scribed in that book, you know, when someone asked me to sign it for them, the citation, it's all about sharing. And that was it. It was me having the opportunity to write a book and then really sharing that opportunity with the team at Bouchon at the time. And so that began this idea of allowing others to really impart their skill, their knowledge, their expertise, you know, with oversight of this great team that we put together with the French Henri cookbook. And then we wrote Under Pressure with Jonathan Benno and Corey Lee. At the time, Ellen Boyles at the time was part of that as well. He was our pastry chef at Per Se at the time, as well as the cast of characters, which are still around there, our great team. And then we wrote Ad Hoc at Home with David Cruz and the team at Ad Hoc. And then we wrote Bouchon Bakery with Sebastian Rouxel and the team at Bouchon Bakery. So it was easy to, it's been easy for me all along to embrace others in this process because it's only natural. They are part of it. They are part of our restaurants. They're part of our bakery. They're part of our lives. They have so much to offer. And one of my duties is to allow them to offer those things. And so the French Henri Per Se is really about those two restaurants and, you know, how one began and how that one bore the other one and how they became siblings at one point and sharing repertoire, sharing ideas, sharing competitiveness, and ultimately sharing individuals. And we share every day between the two restaurants. We see every day, you know, Per Se, and Per Se every day sees French Laundry. And it's just this wonderful, you know, relationship between these two restaurants. And so we think about the evolution of dining and the evolution of fine dining in America. And I talk about that in this book and how important that is. But the significance of this is that there are two restaurants that are critically acclaimed, some of the best restaurants in the country and some of the best restaurants in the world, that are not just about me. They're about the teams that have been there. You know, Eric Siebold, the first chef of cuisine, you know, Corey Lee, Timothy Hollingsworth, Jonathan Benno. I mean, the names go on. And I'm just talking about the kitchen. And you're talking about Bobby Stuckey or Paul Roberts and the wine team. Of course, Laura Cunningham, who established this sense of comfort and ease in the service, which has become so much of a cornerstone of the French Henri and Per Se and other fine dining restaurants as well. She was the youngest woman ever to run a 4-star restaurant, a 3-star Michelin restaurant. It's extraordinary. And so this restaurant has not only left an imprint on all of those, as well as all of those leaving an imprint on the restaurant, but how these two restaurants coming together have established a paradigm for other restaurants to look to as an example of how to achieve, I don't want to say greatness, but how to achieve success at the same time evolve.
You mentioned wanting to hold back and not wanting to do another cookbook. And then you did, and you did a few, and you worked on a few with your teams. And then there was another sort of stop, another sort of pause. Mm-hmm. And it's been basically a decade since the last cookbook. Yeah. And I wonder why now? Like, what made now feel right to you, and why this project right mm-hmm. now? Because you obviously had many options of things you could have done.
Yeah. Well, we started talking about this book as a 25th anniversary book for the French Laundry, but we never really were able to mobilize and get the teams together to do that. You know, we run restaurants. I mean, let's face it. I mean, every day you know, we go in with our list from the night before, and we work to open the restaurant. I mean, that's our focus every day. You know, there are literally 60 people or 70 people every day at French Onion and Per Se, whose sole purpose that day is to get ready for that 5 o'clock or that 5 feeding guest arrival. And that's it. And then you go through service, and at the end of the night, you make your list for tomorrow, and you come in the next day and you do the same thing. And that has to be our goal. Our guests, you know, are part of the most, or should, let me say, the guests are some of the most important part of the equation. Right, our partners who are our suppliers, we want to make sure that we're being responsible to them, you know, and giving them the support that they need to continue with their lifestyles. I mean, just a quick story about Diane St. Clair when she raised the price of her butter a decade ago to me, and she wanted to explain why. And you know, I said, okay, I mean, we're not really going to argue over 50 cents a pound or whatever it was. She said, no, I want to tell you why. My son has been accepted at NYU, and I need to pay for his tuition. Now, what do you say to that? I mean, this is the impact that you have as a guest going into a restaurant. You send a child to NYU, right, to become better educated and become part of a culture and part of a society and make a difference. That's what happens in restaurants over and over again. So it really began, you know, prior to our 25th anniversary in 2019, and we got a little late start. But we got a late start, and we got it accomplished, and it was good. Timing is, I don't want to say is everything, but you know, certainly this timing was a bit difficult with COVID, and I talk about that, you know, in the beginning of the book, is the difficulty with COVID and how important things are now, and how we've become so much more grateful for those around us and those who work with us, and how we must support them. I mean, it really is about supporting. This infrastructure that is really about nourishment, right? I mean, have to protect those individuals that nourish us, and they nourish us with the products. And I can't emphasize that enough. We put this into our bodies. We want to make sure that what we're putting in our bodies is coming from a place that operates with integrity, that operates with honesty, that operates with a sense of responsibility to nourish those who eat their food.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, reading through the book, the story of Diane and her butter really stood out to me. And it's something I noted down as something I wanted to talk about. And you already hit on the personal aspect of it. But the way that the story is framed in the book is part of a section about bread and butter and about taking bread and butter seriously, not as an accoutrement or as something, you know, you do sort of pro forma, but as a course in and of itself. And that attention to detail, both in the product and in the people, is something that I think is evident throughout everything you do and everything you're talking about in the book. And I wonder how you approach things with that level of, you know, seriousness is maybe the wrong word, but that level of interest and sincerity and precision, while also keeping it sort of like human and relatable and something that can be fun instead of something that can only be sort of like, you know, in the narrows and very scholarly and serious.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's fascinating with the whole ideal about bread and butter in restaurants, because, you know, prior to the 60s or sometime in the 60s, neither one of us really remember, because we didn't, I certainly wasn't going out to dinner at the time, and I don't think you were around at the time. there used to be a charge for bread and butter in a restaurant. If you wanted to have bread and butter, you paid for it. And then at some point it became, you know, just part of the process, right? So everybody just started receiving bread and butter, right, for no charge. I'm sure somebody started it to create more value and attract more guests to their restaurant because they didn't charge for bread and butter. And it just kind of became like this afterthought, right? And in many ways, the butter wasn't good, the bread wasn't good. And so it wasn't satisfying anymore. It didn't have that compelling, you know, and when you eat a beautiful piece of bread with beautiful butter, it's like, you know, that in and of itself is almost a meal, right? It's such a satisfying experience. It touches us in so many emotional ways, the aromas, the sound, the textures, you know, all these different things that go on with just a piece of bread and butter. And so, you know, we have here, you know, at Bouchon Bakery, what I believe is one of the best bakers in the country. And, you know, we always think about chefs, right? You always think, well, this Thomas Keller or Daniel Boulud or Jean-Georges Van der Richten or whoever, right? They're always talking about the chef. And I want to try, I'm not trying to deflect, you know, the attention to me, but I'm just trying to make people aware that it's not about the chef. It's about everybody that's on the team and the importance of what they do. I'm not a baker. You know, put me in the kitchen at Bouchon Bakery and ask me to make a loaf of bread, forget about it. You know, so I wanted to bring attention to Francois and the quality of work that he does and the dedication that he does in such an artisanal way. I mean, he's dealing with flour, water, salt, and yeast. And then the environment, which changes every day. And so he's trying to produce this consistent, beautiful bread for us to enjoy. And at the Franchani for years, for over two decades, you know, we had this beautiful array of bread in a basket that would be served to you, and you would choose one or two pieces, and you would get two different kinds of butter. And it was significant, you know, because it was quality, and Francois or the baker previous to him, Matthew, were really artisans and craftsmen and really made beautiful bread. And we had Diane St. Clair's butter, and we had a butter that was made here in Sonoma as well. And so we used those butters with the bread. But it didn't become a focal point for people. And I wanted to make that. I wanted to represent Francois as part of the team. I wanted to represent Diane again as part of our partnership and part of the importance of supporting somebody like that, the story I just told about her son. And so it became obvious, right? The obvious way to do that is to have a bread and butter course.
This week's episode is presented by Zenith. I had the opportunity last week to sit down with CEO Julian Tornare and Product Development and Heritage Director Roman Marietta to chat about the brand's latest novelties, including the Defy Classic Carbon, the Pilot Type 20 Blueprint, as well as get a little sneak peek as to what's to come in 2021. So, direct from Switzerland, here are Julian and Roman. Thank you both so much for joining us. It's good to have you both here on the show with us.
Hi, Stephen. How are you?
Thank you, Stephen.
The first thing I want to talk about is the Defy Classic Carbon. People may know, yeah, carbon fibers used in watches, but never quite like this. Can you kind of start off by just giving us a basic overview of what the Defy Classic Carbon is and why it's so special?
Sure. You know, Defy for us has been an amazing product line for the last 3 years. The contemporary expression of Zenith. And we wanted something new in terms of material. So we went from our Defy Classic and we said, let's do it in a material that we have never used in such a way, meaning every single element in carbon, as well as the bracelet.
Well, the challenge for us was to integrate this request from Julien and to develop something very technical, because it's something that we haven't done in the past. I mean, it was the first ever for us to introduce and to work on a full carbon watch, and especially the bracelet. So it was quite a dive into the unknown for us. And at the end, it ended with a super cool and super light product. And just keep the idea of the Defy Classic, which is a three-hands watch with the Elite movement.
You know, we're used to seeing carbon in watch cases, on bezels, those sorts of things. But this watch is really, you know, as we've said, is carbon everywhere. Like anything that can be carbon is carbon. And I wonder what, from your perspectives, is appealing about carbon as a material. You know, for the end consumer, what are the things that they'll actually experience on a day-to-day basis that make this material so interesting and special for a watch case and a watch bracelet?
In that particular case, I see two main differences. The first one is the lightness. The watch is really impressive when you put it on your wrist. And then in terms of look, and I was the one challenging Roman on that, I wasn't really sure of the rendering, but once I saw the watch, you have kind of a camouflage look of this carbon treatment, which makes it really, really nice to have on your wrist. So I think it makes it so different from every other thing we have.
We have to educate also our audience, especially in the DeFi collection, which is contemporary and targeting younger clientele, that we are able to do such a technical innovation. So it's really in the approach of the DeFi collection, which is challenging the boundaries of innovation. So that was the goal also of creating such a piece.
There are so many things about this watch, especially as you kind of dig down into the details, that make it interesting. But there are other novelties that have come out recently that I want to make sure we get a chance to touch on. And two of them are the Pilot Type 20 Blueprint and the El Primero Chronomaster Revival Liberty, which we've spoken about a little bit before. You know, the Type 20 is it's a classic tool watch. It's really a sort of no-nonsense watch. And this is a really conceptual execution. And I wonder what drew you to that idea. And then also, if there are any specific details on that piece that you want to draw people's attention to, because I think it's a watch that, in my experience, the more I look at it, the more I find intriguing about it.
What is really interesting with the Blueprint dial, especially, is that nobody has ever, I would say, recreate or show on the front face of a watch technical indication that you find normally on the technical plans and drawings from our suppliers, from the dial suppliers, the dial manufacturer. We found some blueprints of the architecture of the buildings of the manufacturer. And when we saw these plans, these technical plans, we thought it could be very interesting to implement it in the pilots. The way you can obtain this is to work on a multi-layered dial, and that's what we have been creating, which gives the idea and the feelings that all the markings and numerals are flying above the dial, which of course make the link with the Pilot collection and the fact that it's a tool watch for adventurer and pilot lovers.
2020 is starting to wind up, and we're starting to approach 2021. And I wonder, are you able to offer us any kind of sneak peek at what we might be able to look forward to from Zenith in the next few months and maybe even the next year?
Yes, we could. 2021 is definitely the year for Chronomaster. There will be new things coming, some referring to the very classic design of 1969, some a bit more modern, a bit more contemporary, giving a spirit that existed at Zenith, but in a slightly different way. And of course, continue to capitalize with watches that became icons. And I'm talking about A384, A385, and others. So that's going to be an amazing year for Zenith, and we are all very, very excited about that.
That's great. I think sounds like there's a lot to look forward to. And thank you both for joining us. This has been a lot of fun. I'm glad to hear things are going well over in Switzerland and that we have a lot to look forward to from Zenith over the coming months.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
Thank you, Stephen. Stay safe.
Thank you so much to Julian and Roman for joining us and for sharing a little bit of insight into the latest novelties from Zenith. If you want to learn more, visit zenithwatches.com. All right, let's get back to the show. In framing everything you do, you know, I was trying to think of a metaphor or an analogy is a restaurant and are a chef, is it a symphony and you're a composer? Is it a painting and you're the painter? Like, what is the sort of analogy that we can draw? And I kept coming up blank, and I think for a good reason. I think I finally figured it out, which is that, you know, a painter takes paint, which is made, still something made by somebody, and they make their own thing. But the end consumer doesn't really get any sort of experience if they just go to the store and buy that tube of paint, no matter how good it is. In the same way that someone who's not a trained musician can go buy the world's finest violin, and it doesn't matter if there's not someone to play it and a beautiful thing for them to play. Whereas on a certain level, you know, the products that you're getting, whether it's Diane's butter or whether it's produce from someone or meat from a really fabulous farm, those are products that in their own way are sort of a completed piece of art in some way, but then you're taking them and doing something new. You're almost sort of like remixing all of this stuff. And I wonder how you think about that in terms of you're dealing with these products that already have a wonderful sort of amount of love and craft put into them. You have your team who is also helping you make these things. It's not just you. And yet, like, what the guest wants to come away with is, to some extent, like, they want a Thomas Keller meal. Like, they want something mm-hmm. that still has your fingerprints mm-hmm. on it. And mm-hmm. I wonder how you balance that as you're trying to mm-hmm. sort of be respectful on both ends of that equation.
Wow. What a well said, well asked, very difficult question to answer, but I certainly will do my best. I mean, you know, you talked about, you know, an artist, a painter, a musician in an orchestra. We call what we do in our restaurant the dance, because we are in such flux, in such movement. And that sense of awareness that you have of what's going on and those around you, and how beautifully that dance can happen, and happen every night. And that dance could be at a moment when there is a heightened energy in the restaurant because the amount of guests that are there or who's there. There's all these, every day is different, but it's still the dance. And it's really, really beautiful to watch it, to watch people and young people who may not have the experience that some of the veterans have in that dance, but how they become, you know, part of that choreography and that movement, and they can move through spaces without touching anybody, and with elegance and sophistication. And it's really a beautiful thing to watch. And so that's kind of what we do is this dance. So I would say more of a choreographer, but in a way of, and I'm blanking on the name of the was it Alvin Ailey, who did the freeform dance, right? Somebody like that, right? Who has evolved dance to a place where it's much more spontaneous, if you will. And I think that's what's the beautiful thing about a restaurant is the dance. The ingredients, as you spoke about, yes, they are extremely important. Cooking, for everybody who's listening, is a very simple equation. It's about ingredients and execution. And, you know, our job is to make sure that we get the best ingredients available. And people always say, you know, I want my pea soup to taste like your pea soup. And I said, well, that's probably not going to happen because you can't get the same peas that I can get, you know. But, you know, that's and what I'm saying there is make sure that when you're buying the ingredients for the pea soups, you're not just going out and buying any peas. You're actually tasting them. You're analyzing them for flavors, right? And if you can't find anything fresh, then buy frozen, because frozen peas in many times have been picked at that height of flavor and will work as well. But the point being is that, you know, the ingredients that we receive are sometimes some of the most extraordinary ingredients in available to anybody, and many times rare in small supply. Diane St. Clair butter, we talked about, is a perfect example of that. She doesn't make a lot. She has 8 cows. How much butter can she make? She's one woman. I mean, she works 7 days a week, and she can only make so much butter. So you're really not going to be able to buy Diane St. Clair's butter, but it doesn't mean there's somebody close by you that has a dairy farm that sells butter that you can buy and support them. But our job as cooks is to really, I don't want to say process, because process doesn't sound well. Our job is to take these wonderful ingredients and elevate the flavors that are possible from these ingredients with things like salt or things like acid or things like grilling or simple techniques that are available to us and available to everybody, and make sure that we don't complicate them, that we don't overthink the whole process of cooking, and be respectful to the ingredients. Always be respectful to the ingredients and those who bring it to us. And so we that's what we talk about, and that's what we try to do, is to heighten the flavor profiles of the ingredients we receive from the extraordinary people that supply them to us, give them to our guests in a way that they're gonna experience that and understand what a pea tastes like, or what a strawberry tastes like, or what a beautiful piece of beef or lamb tastes like.
Mm. Yeah, I love the idea that you sort of have to get from point A to point B, and there's different ways to do that, but you always know kind of what that end goal is and what that guiding light is. And I wonder for that process in the middle, that space in between point A and point B, you know, this is where I think there's actually a really sort of close connection between what you do and watchmaking and other sorts of things that anything we could sort of describe as craftsmanship of one kind or another. Is there's a sort of fetishization of doing things by hand and the old-fashioned way, and you know, we could analyze why that is, but one of the recipes you discuss in the book is the cornet, the cone with the salmon in it, for people who don't know, and you should read this story in the book. It's really incredible. But one of the things you talk about is how you've changed as the restaurant has grown how you process the salmon, and it's gone from hand chopping it with a knife and picking the sinews out by hand to using not an industrialized process, but using like modern machines and equipment so that you can do it better, faster. And, you know, I think there would be a certain old way of looking at things that might say like, oh, well, you lose something when there's not the hand, or you lose something by using these modern techniques.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I wonder your thoughts on that and how you balance whatever your thoughts are on that with ultimately delivering the best thing to the guest and to the customer.
Yeah, it's a good question. And you think about that in so many different ways. But, you know, for us, it's a sense of refinement. You know, this is what we're doing. We talked about, you know, the tools of refinement in the French Arnie cookbook 22 years ago. And it hasn't changed. We're always looking for that sense of refinement. So yes, you know, hand chopping the salmon, right? Pulling out the sinew, to putting it through a grinder, and then putting it through a tammy, right? So it's a sense of refinement, but it's also, you know, when you think about the process, so what is the most respectful way to take care of the salmon, right? The ingredient that we're talking about. When you're hand chopping it, it takes quite a while. So the temperature of the product is being elevated, right? So when the temperature elevates, you start to diminish the quality and the freshness of that, right? In the salmon, we're not cooking it; we're just having it out, you know, on the table. So we're hand chopping it. We want to make sure that we keep it as fresh and as lively flavors as we possibly can. So now, when we grind it, we can grind it super cold, and it goes very quickly to stay super cold. Our grinders are cold. Our protein is cold. We're in a cold room. Right, so we didn't have a cold room back then. Now we have a cold room. We pass it through a tammy, and it's all done in 10 or 15 minutes, as opposed to 30 to 45 minutes. And so that's part of the process is we refine the process to produce a better result. And that's what we're always trying to do, is to try to find a better result. So that's evolution. That's paying attention and being aware of what you're doing and trying to think about, how can I do this better? You know, that's one of our fundamental goals, is every day we want to come in with the idea of, how can we improve ourselves? How can we improve what we're doing? How can we improve the experience? And it can be something really small. And when you talk about the salmon and the evolution of chopping the salmon to grinding the salmon, it's relatively small, you know, when you think about it, but the result is quite large. I mean, you take the green tape. You know, in the first decade at the French Laundry, the green tape that we always taped down the past with, or label things with, was always torn, right? We tore the green tape and wrote on it. I mean, intelligent people coming through the restaurant, the Grant Atkinses of the world, the Mark Hoppers of the world, the Jonathan Bennos of the world, the Stephen Durfees of the world, the Eric Zeebles of the world. I mean, everybody tore the green tape for an entire decade until we opened Per Se. And I explained to the team that was going to Per Se to help inoculate the new team there with their culture and philosophy and repertoire. I had a little meeting with them. I said, I want you to go to New York and think about ways that you can make improvements, so that when you're talking to these new team members, you're talking in a way of evolution, of teaching them a better way than we even do at the French Laundry. And Zion Cruel, who is the expediter on that Noah's Ark of people that went to Per Se, the first day he was taping down the pass, he picked up a pair of scissors and cut the green tape. And you would think the world ended. I mean, there was not a sound in the entire restaurant, and everybody just looked at him like, "What did you just do?" And from that moment on, in all the restaurants that we had, you know, people put a pair of scissors with the green tape. Now, how easy was that to make a small improvement that impacted everybody that worked for our restaurants and those who now see what we do as an example?
Yeah, and you know, the green tape moment was one of my favorite moments from the book. I promise I will be driving everyone in my life absolutely crazy talking about green tape moments for the next 6 to 12 months. So I apologize in advance to everyone who's going to have to listen to me blabber on about that. But you know, the idea that a small gesture of adding that extra level of care and precision speaks to another thing you said in the book, which is that ultimately you think that luxury and fine dining are about that. They're about precision. And I wanted to see if you could elaborate on that a little bit and give us a little more insight there.
Yeah. You know, refinement, precision, it's almost the same purpose and the same goal. We are continuously, when you talk about anything that's great, you want to make sure that you can be consistent, right? Consistency is critical. We all can cook. You come to my restaurant, I can cook you a meal that's going to really impress you. You're gonna love it. Can I do that every night for 100 people? Right. That is the most important thing, because we all know we can cook. We all know that we can impress people with what we do, with our ingredients, with our skills, with our knowledge, with our equipment, with our tools, with our plating, with our service, with our everything that we do. But can we do it consistently? So that's what we're always striving for in our restaurants, is to produce something over and over again. And if we can find the sense of precision in that. So just think about using an immersion circulator, which we don't, let's not even think about using an immersion circulator, because that's a thing of the past for us as well. I mean, that lasted for us for maybe 3 years or 4 years, the idea of an immersion circulator. And for those of you who don't know what it is, an immersion circulator was more or less a heating device that was used in the medical world. And it would keep a water bath at specific temperatures for as long as the electricity was on. So we could put a piece of meat in a bag and turn and dial in a temperature at 64 degrees Celsius and put the bag in there and leave it in for 45 minutes, and it would come out a perfect medium rare, right? So that every time, you didn't need to have the saucier anymore, you know, using his skill, his knowledge or his experience to cook a piece of meat medium rare. You had the ability to have a machine do that for you. Without those immersion circulators are gone, now we have what are rationale ovens, which do the same thing and are much more versatile and in so many different ways. We can use it for so many different things. So that's kind of taking the place of the immersion circulator. With that said, it's interesting because what we also have to balance here, right? So we know we can be precise making anything, right? We have the tools and the equipment. We have the knowledge and the experience in terms of our past experience with temperatures and times and these different things. We can do that. And that's not a problem. So consistency in that aspect is a given. But what have we lost in that way as well? And so we have to balance the technology of precision with the idea that the skill level, right, of us as cooks, we are cooks, and that's one of our jobs, is to actually cook. And the pleasure of actually cooking, and this is something that I always want to express to those at home, is it's a process. It's a process that should be fun. It should be pleasurable. I love to cook. I love the action of cooking. So we don't want to give up this opportunity to not only teach and learn, but to execute over and over again, roasting, you know, a loin of lamb conventionally, and understanding when it's the perfect time to take it out of the oven, so that after it rests, it's a perfect medium rare. And it's interesting because young chefs really love that, and as a young chef, I love that as well. So it's a sense of balancing in precision and skill. And we have to make sure that we're doing that correctly, so that we can be consistent with what we do. And I think watchmaking is the same way. There's a sense of automation, if you will, right, to be precise. But there's also this wonderful craft of making a watch in the same way as craft of cooking. So I think they the two professions really marry well together as they evolve, right? You can become more precise, right? Because of the technology and equipment that you can employ you to become more precise, but the craftsmanship has to be there as well.
Yeah, I really like that comparison because they both ultimately focus on giving the guest something that is good, both in an objective sense and a subjective sense, right? It's about not just keeping the best time, but it's doing it in a way that brings someone pleasure. And mm-hmm. in the same way, it's like you can cook I have had many, many a perfectly medium rare steak that are just like not that great, or like mm-hmm. it's not in a satisfying environment or whatever. And yeah. so you can do something well and still have it not like touch you, like it can be meaningless. Mm-hmm. And that balance is really at the heart of everything you're doing, right? Is making sure that every person who leaves mm-hmm. the French Laundry or Per Se or any of your other restaurants leaves there feeling like this is a thing they're going to hold on to in some way, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, food is all about an emotional connection. So we all live through and again, there's evolution, right, in food, and you can mark history with the different trends. I hate that we use the word trends, but the different movements, let's call them movements. I mean, Escoffier, in the Auguste Escoffier, who was one of the greatest chefs of ever time, in the early 1900s, he formalized the brigade system, right, which is the system that we use in the kitchen today. There's a chef, there's a sous chef, there's chef de parties or commis, and you knew when you walked into a kitchen in his era who the chef de cuisine was, who the head chef was, because his toque was the highest one. I mean, you could identify him right away. It's much like the military brigade. I mean, you know the general because he has stars on his shoulders. You know the colonel because he has a cluster, right? You know the lieutenant because he has a bar. You know the captain because he has two bars, right? That's kind of the system that Escoffier set up in a kitchen brigade. At the same time, he codified recipes, which no one had ever done before. Here's the way you make a hollandaise sauce. Here are the five mother sauces that all the other sauces are derived from. I mean, he codified everything that happened in terms of recipes in a kitchen. We still use those classic recipes 120 years later. We're still using Escoffier's recipes as a foundation for cooking. And it's very important to understand and learn those foundations. Again, same way in watchmaking, right? They're still using, the same techniques and the same precision, the same working environments that they did back then. So the emotional, talk about the emotional connection to food, right? This is very, very important. And as I started to speak about, you have these different movements, right? Escoffier talked about nouvelle cuisine before there was ever a nouvelle cuisine written about in the 70s, right? And then you start to realize that every generation has nouvelle cuisine. Every generation has nouvelle cuisine. Why? Because every generation has new fashion. Every generation has new music. Every generation has new art. It's an interpretation of what they learned from those who taught them, from those who mentored them. And this is a natural movement. It never was related to food in our country because food wasn't really that important in so many parts of our history. But Escoffier talked about nouvelle cuisine. So you can mark the different eras of culinary movement by these different moments. And you think about the last one, or well, with Tao, three movements ago, in the intellectual food, right? This idea of a molecular gastronomy, which is more or less a media used for media purposes because they have to explain something in very short sentences. But the idea of molecular gastronomy as a movement, and it's interesting because molecular gastronomy at the time, and of course it was really poorly named, but we'll use that term because I think most people would identify with it, was an idea of intellectual food, right? You went through a process, you had a strawberry, you dipped it in a powder, you chewed it for 20 seconds, and then you drank a liquid, right? And that was the experience with the strawberry. It was a new kind of an experience. It was an experience that made you think about the powder, the strawberry, and the liquid. And why did it make you think? Because you never had it before. So you were left with not, is this good or bad? You were left with, do I like it or not, right? Whereas emotional cuisine, right? Puree of potatoes. We've all had puree of potatoes many, many times in our lives. And we know when we have a good one and a bad one. And we know when we've had one that's better than ever. And so that's an emotional connection to food because you've experienced those things before. And so that's the difference between the two and these ideas of movements in the culinary profession. But each movement leaves its mark on the next generation in so many ways. We tend to eliminate the fluff, if you will. We tend to eliminate the non-important stuff, but we hold on to the good things that we learn, that we embrace, that we're able to use moving forward. And that's that part of evolution that we so much talk about. But for me, emotions plays the most important part of cooking, right? Is to be able to give somebody an emotional experience. And an emotional experience is a memory in many ways. And so we think about success. What does success mean to us? You know, certainly we know it's not about fame. It's not about fortune. Success is about giving somebody a memory of it that they embrace and they have for the rest of their lives. And I can talk to you, you know, for hours about memories of food that I've eaten in different places, and not all haute cuisine, some of them very simple foods with people, friends and family and loved ones. And so we think about, you know, what we eat, how we eat. It needs to be, it's important. I don't want to say it's not important, but remember, it's only food. And it's the moment and time that you are there and those who you are with that really define the experience at a much higher level than the food.
Yeah, I think that's something that we always talk about in relation to watches, is they're just watches. And yeah. You know, we touched at the beginning of this conversation on the fact that for you, collecting watches is in large part a way to sort of mark milestones. And I think meals and food can be the same thing. I mean, I remember every graduation dinner, every, you know, important family milestone in my family was always marked with food. And that's now what my wife and I do. And it's those are powerful things. And I think the, whether it's watches or food, anything that you can preface with, well, it's just whatever, can also be a really deep, meaningful, and important thing.
Mm-hmm. I agree 100%. Yeah.
I want to touch on, we're starting to run low on time here, but one thing I want to touch on, mostly because it spoke to me as somebody who traffics in words for a living. At the very back of the book, you have a little glossary, I would say, that is the importance of words. And some examples are that things are, you sort of give a thing and then what it shouldn't be called. And it's a towel, not a rag. It's the kitchen, not the back of house. It's influence, not inspiration. And I wonder what your thinking is behind this section. And if there are any others that ended up not making it into the cookbook that feel particularly important to you right now.
Yeah, it's a good question. I love this. I love the use of words. And it really became... a realization for me is when, you know, I started as a dishwasher, right? My mother put me in front of a dishwasher, whatever, you know, 41 years ago or 45 years ago. I can't remember. And the idea that this was, you know, one of the stations, you know, one of the departments in that restaurant. And it was just, you know, it was a private yacht club in Palm Beach or even before that, you know, it was a continental cuisine restaurant in Laurel, Maryland. You know, I've worked in so many of them as a dishwasher, as a youngster for my mother. And the idea that, and what I learned there is that this was a really important part of the restaurant. You know, the porter, the dishwasher, right? He was pivotal in the success of the restaurant. If the bartender didn't have glasses, then they couldn't make a drink for the guests. If the servers didn't have silverware, they couldn't set the table. If the chef didn't have plateware, he couldn't plate the food. And so I was the person that really impacted all these other departments. I mean, the bartender and the chef really didn't really need to engage together, right? The bartender made drinks and the chef made food. There wasn't a lot of engagement there unless the chef made food for the bar. But the dishwasher needed to be part of everybody's experience, right? And that was and I realized that. So when, you know, going into a restaurant as a semi-professional for my first time and someone describing that area as the dish pit really bothered me. It's like that, you know, it's like that was back there. I didn't work in a pit. And so that kind of was always part of one of my pet peeves, right? You know, to me, it was never a pit. And so again, evolution, you start to think about this and someone says, give me a rag in a restaurant. You go, well, that's, I don't want to see a rag in my restaurant. You know, I want to see a towel, right? These things, the way we describe things became really important to me. And I wanted to make sure that our staff, right, that those who we were mentoring understood the importance of words as well. You know, grease, that was also one of my pet peeves. Like, you know, I mean, grease, it's like, I understand the term greasy spoon, right? It's the restaurant down the street, it's the diner or whatever it was, you know, back in the day. But none of us consume grease. It's not good for us. It's just, it would really hurt us to consume grease. It may be the oily spoon, right? Or the fatty spoon, but it's not the greasy spoon. It just doesn't work that way. So we use fats and oils in all our restaurants. And yes, maybe some people use too much oil or too much fat, but that's what we cook with and that's what we eat. And so to understand that it's not grease and the importance of those words. You know, scraps, you know, that's another word I always hated. They're not scraps. We're trimming our food, right? So I'm not telling somebody to go scrap the salmon. I'm saying go trim the salmon, right? So what comes off of that is trimmings, not scraps. So it's just some of these things are obvious. I always love to use, you know, we use some words to define what we need. So if I walk into the kitchen and say, Jimmy, right? Everybody in the kitchen knows that they're supposed to buff their workstations. It's Jimmy Buffett, right? So that kind of stuff is just fun. Or give me a baseball, right? Which means that you want a fresh towel, right? So, you know, your towels become soiled during the service. And if you ask for a baseball, you know, someone throws you, you know, a fresh, clean, white towel in the same way that you'd be on a baseball diamond. You get a fresh baseball, pure white. So those are some of the things that we think about, we talk about in trying to elevate the vocabulary of our profession to be truly a profession. Remember, it wasn't until the 60s that the Labor Department reclassified us cooks, professional cooks. We were all considered domestic help. We were labeled, even the cooks back then who worked in the best restaurants in the country were considered domestic help. It wasn't until the 60s they reclassified it into a profession, culinary profession.
That is super interesting. I did not know that. That is extremely fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, the last thing I want to ask you about is we've touched on it a couple times kind of lightly, but now is obviously a tough time for restaurants. You know, here in LA County, even outdoor dining is not allowed right now. Yeah. And I wonder from your perspective for people like me, and I'm sure many of the people listening who love restaurants and for whom restaurants are an important part of our lives, what can we do right now to support the restaurants we love and support the food community, your suppliers, the people who make the hardware you use in the kitchens, all of these things to make sure that these great places are still there for us when things go back to normal?
Well, there's certainly a number of things you can do. You know, supporting the IRC and the NRA, those are the Independent Restaurant Coalition and the National Restaurant Association. Those are two ways to support the efforts that we're making for our profession through our leaders, right? So talking to your congressmen, talking to your senators, making sure that they understand how important restaurants are. They are the fabric of our community. They are the cornerstones of our neighborhoods. I mean, you know, there are going to be so many restaurants that are not going to reopen. And it's going to be a sad day when we come out of COVID and we realize the favorite sandwich shop that we used to go to, you know, once or twice a week is no longer there. And where'd they go? Well, they went away because, you know, they couldn't afford to stay open. And how do you support that restaurant? How do you support that? It's hard to because they're not open. So what do you do to support them? The only way to support them is to make sure that our leaders understand how critical it is to support this profession. You know, we are the largest employer behind the U.S. government, which means we are the largest private employer in America. Think about that. Over 16 million people. And that's just talking about the profession itself. I'm not talking about all of the supply chain individuals, our farmers, fishermen, foragers, gardeners, the linen companies, the garbage companies, the electricians, the florists. I mean, you know, on and on, the people that support restaurants or are supported by restaurants. And you think about that, right? We employ more women than anybody besides the U.S. government. We have significant impact on generations. So many people have their first jobs at restaurants, right? I mean, there's so many people who've gone to college. Yeah, I used to work at a restaurant when I was a kid, right? There are so many people who have their second chances in a restaurant who are coming out of something that's been a bad position for them, something that's happened in their life. And one of their first places to go is to get a job in a restaurant because it's easy, right? So it's the second chance place. And it's also the third opportunity for somebody. It's the elderly, right? We employ more elderly than anybody, right? So you go to McDonald's or you go to anywhere, a restaurant where you have elderly working to subsidize their income, right? So it's important to remember the impact that restaurants have on our society and certainly on our neighborhoods and each other. So try to support them. Support your farmers if you can. That's another way. It's not directly supporting restaurants, but if the farmers go away, then the restaurants aren't going to have that source. Any way you can support those farmers and, you know, go online and try to find a farmer that you can support, whether Farmer Lee Jones in Ohio or Keith Martin in Pennsylvania. Those are two people that I work with closely. But there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of small farms around the country that you could find in your own communities and support them in ways that they need to be supported now because they don't have restaurants to sell to. And we all see that. We talk about, you know, to-go and takeout, and those things are available. So, of course, you know, supporting your restaurants by going to those restaurants who are doing takeout and being able to buy that. Buying gift certificates is one way of supporting them, but it's not. I don't think it's the best way because, you know, they're getting money today where which they're going to have to give back tomorrow. And so that's, you know, it's almost like robbing from Peter to pay Paul. But, you know, gift certificates are one way to support them now. And making sure that when you do use your gift certificate, you know, use it in a thoughtful way, or don't use it at all, right? Just give it a contribution to them. There are so many restaurants like our restaurants that have a restaurant relief fund. So we have the Keller Restaurant Relief Fund, where we're supporting, we furloughed over 1,100 people in March. We've brought back around 400 of them since we've started to reopen. So there's the other 600, which we've supported through contributions and donations to our 501c3. And, you know, we've helped them manage their lives by giving them grants for rents, for utilities, for daycare, for whatever they need, for whatever they need, they'll apply for a grant. We've given away over $500,000 to over 480 individuals in our grant program. And that's very meaningful. So those are ways to support restaurants and support their staff. So just some examples of what you can do, continue to be supportive, continue to voice those concerns, continue to share your concerns with others so that they hear the need that we have and the challenges that we're gonna face coming out of this.
Amazing. Yeah, we will link up in the show notes to many of the places you just mentioned. So if you're listening to this, check out the show notes and we'll have links so that you can go through and support all of these really, really important organizations. Chef, this has been a ton of fun. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I really enjoyed the book and I again, highly recommend everybody listening go order themselves a copy. It's a really, really fabulous, fabulous thing.
Thank you. Steven, it's good talking to you. I appreciate the time. You know, we've made so many connections here between, you know, several of our loves, you know, watches and food. So I appreciate that. Take care.
Thank you again to Chef Thomas Keller and his team for their generosity. This week's episode was recorded in Los Angeles and Yountville, California, and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.